in the night that he left, he had lifted his hand to me, and it was quite traumatic, right. You know, and that happened on a Sunday night, and on a Monday morning I was sent out to school.
Like nothing had happened.
Nothing had happened.
I came through. So there was a period during that where I attempted to take my own life again. I went into the garage and attempted to kind of hang myself. One of the guys that kind of co-founded the group, Keep Reading Me, a number of years ago, almost called me out on it, you know, and had went, I kind of know, and I was like, oh, what do you mean, you know, and he's like, I'm kind of the same.
Today we're talking to David Rosling from Keep the Heed, a local men's only group based in Blantyre, all about mental being and looking after each other. Can you tell us a wee bit about yourself?
Yep, I'm newly turned 46 on Saturday.
Don't look at me over.
I'm 46 and I probably have lived with anxiety since I was about 14, 15. That's when I started to recognise it. I try and use the word suffer with anxiety. Mm-hmm. I try and use the word live with anxiety. Like suffer's kind of a lot of negative connotations. And when I speak to people, when they say they suffer, I kind of try and flip that for them and say that we kind of live with anxiety. And that was the anxiety around about 14, 15. I didn't really know what it was or anything. My mum had taken me to my GP and they put it down to exams coming up. I didn't really care much for my exams, so I knew it wasn't really that, but my doctor's telling you that, and that's, so I just put it down to that. So I didn't really know what it was. That when I think back, that was probably my first experience of feeling anxious and going through anxiety. And the kind of stuff, like I know about anxiety, wasn't until later on in life when I reflected back on my life where I realised that I lived my life probably in a lot of fear of things, and it's probably held me back in life for doing things because I've always had this fear of what if, and it's always been what if, and has been a negative. So kind of later, when I was kind of in my early 20s, again, I started to experience low mood, and that kind of came in the form of not really sleeping, overthinking with things again. Went back to GP and they gave me some sleeping tablets just to take to try and get asleep. And I took the sleeping tablets for about a week and then kind of ditched them. And that was around about speaking to a male family member, and it was really so much, you don't need stuff like that.
Man up, put your big boy pants on.
Mm-hmm. Aye, just go home. Things will be all right. Whatever you go to be depressed about kind of thing. And I was like, all right, okay, aye, okay. So
that phrase, what have you got to be depressed about? I hear that all the time, you know. Yeah.
I kind of plodded through life. I wasn't always depressed or low mood. If kind of looking at me, I think, oh, that guy's pretty much all right. So I kind of did go through that. I didn't really then experience the kind of anxiety and low mood, or it didn't really affect my life again until I was maybe in my mid-30s. And again, went back to GP and spoke to my GP, and it was medication that was prescribed to me with this will be a 6-month thing, get 4 or 5 weeks to kick in, and it'll be short term, 6 months. That then led to 18 months. Went back and asked it to reduce. So My kind of lifestyle probably wasn't very healthy. She was drinking drugs at the weekend, and I was the kind of terrace culture scene at the football. And for the outside, my life probably looked pretty good, as if things were all right. I was kind of crumbling inside, though. I kind of stopped. I came off medication, but I was kind of through discussions with my GP. I didn't just go cold turkey. We spoke about that and it reduced. But I found myself about a year later, the real anxiety and that coming back, and my mindset was, it's because I'm not taking this medication anymore. I wasn't really implementing anything kind of healthy or positive in my life. So I went back to GP again and again. It was depressants that was prescribed to me, and I took them for a few years at that point. And then my life changed. I was married and people probably thought that my life was going pretty all right, but I was leading a lifestyle that suggested that's not married.
So to the outside world, everything looked okay, but actually the reality was it did.
So there's kind of a few things in my life that I was doing that I wasn't behaving in the best of ways. I split up with my wife through my kind of infidelity and stuff. And really at that point, that's when my mental health really deteriorated. I really struggled to deal with the shame and the guilt of what I had done. and I isolated myself from my pals and stuff, and I didn't really do much. I kind of kept out of the house, but I was using drugs when I was in the house, cocaine. My use of cocaine wasn't recreational. It was a coping mechanism for me. And as I say, I really isolated myself. And my self-esteem and everything was really low. Suicidal ideation was a daily occurrence for me as well. And kind of October 2018, I made a plan to end my life.
Okay.
And I knew what I was going to do, I knew where I was going, and I knew I had this plan. And at this point, my son was living, I lives in Saltcoats, and I was taking him home. My daughter's older, so she was driving down, and while she's driving down, so my two kids are in the car. I'm making this plan to end my life. And
nobody would have had an idea that was
nobody had an idea in the... Almost the kind of strange thing about it is I remember that night in the car going down, and I was messaging my boss to say that I couldn't come in the next day. I had an appointment I had to go to because I knew where I was going. I had booked train tickets, not that I knew where I was going. And I remember my two kids being in, and I think when I tell people that, they think that's really sad. I was actually really calm, and I felt as if I had a lot of clarity at that point, and I actually felt really at peace. Which I know might sound strange to people, but really at peace. I went home that night, and I woke up the next morning, and I went to the train station, and I don't know what it is, I don't know what it was, but something in my mindset changed, and I crossed over and got a train back, and I went straight to my GP's, and I just walked into my GP's and told the receptionist that she was a bit like, oh, and a doctor seen me right away, and was very good. To be honest, the GP that I seen was very good, but told me I had a 12-week wait until I could see somebody. When I was trying to see him, I didn't know if I could wait that long, and I was really broken. And we sat in, and he really took the time. He did take some time to speak to me and made sure I was safe, and we had a safe plan in place for that. I then went home, and I was staying at my mum's through the breakup of my marriage, and I told my mum what was going on. So that was a wee bit of relief as well. It was, you know, somebody else had spoken to a doctor, spoken to my mum. And I waited for this call that I was going to get for the mental health.
This 12-week call.
And it never came. So I had went back to my GP for a separate issue in the February. And during that visit, I'd asked about it, and I discovered that there had been a break in communication, and that's why I hadn't went any further. So at that point, I reached out to Chrissy's house in Wishaw. And the suicidal ideation wasn't as much there. My mood was pretty low, and that kind of really knocked me at that point, because I suppose for the 12 weeks I was clinging on to this hope that something was going to fix me. And when that didn't come, I started to panic a wee bit again. I reached out to Chrissy's house, who were absolutely wonderful. They saved my life, and I don't say that by any...
It's a great organisation.
They were absolutely wonderful. So I went there and met with two people up there, and I was assigned to a counsellor up there, and I'd done some CBT work and that up there, and that helped massively. The mistake that I made, and that was my responsibility, is I thought when I'd done that would be me fixed, that I didn't need to keep up the kind of good habits and that I had, and I left there, and that was fine. And as I said, my self-esteem and that was rock bottom. I had a lot of shame and guilt for how I had treated my wife, and I just thought I'd be on my own forever. What then resulted was I threw myself into a relationship, which turned out, if it's all right with you, I don't want to go into it too much. It was a very abusive relationship. The reason I don't want to go into it too much is I still have that fear that there'll be a comeback for me on that. Secondly, as well, the relationship that I'm in now is absolutely wonderful and beautiful, and I don't want to kind of be disrespectful of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I take a wee step back, if you don't mind me asking? From start to finish, you said, my understanding of that, you didn't talk to anybody apart from your doctor and latterly your mother.
Yeah.
Was there nobody you worked beside or family members that nobody turned around and, I know it's, we all put this big brave face on, but there's nobody that turned around and says, no, we all say this, are you okay? Are you really okay? Is there nobody that you could have turned around and said, I feel myself?
There probably was, but for me, I didn't want to say that.
Admitting shame and the guilt in you to say, I'm not a real man?
I, No, so much. I don't think it was so much with that I'm not a real man, but and this is only work that I've done recently through counselling stuff about my core beliefs that I'm not good enough, I'm not important enough and stuff like that. With the kind of lifestyle that I had, I was pretty much involved in the football casual scene. Mm. So my ego was massive, and I didn't want people to think, if I admitted to that, then
he's not
the character that I was putting on a Saturday when I was out. It was almost like I had this character to protect, so I didn't want anybody knowing. But when I'd isolated myself, like the shame and the guilt that I felt, I thought people could see right through me, and they could, they were this character, bravado.
Is that what you were displaying?
Absolutely.
Tough and struggling.
And that isn't me at all. That was the authentic me. But when that happened and I started to feel the shame and guilt, I felt that people could see right through me, and everybody in the world would just see this scared wee boy that was actually inside me that hadn't really dealt with a lot of things for childhood and stuff. Just, I know I'm kind of jumping a bit back here, but my childhood was, my dad was an alcoholic, and I never really had much of a relationship with him, just purely because he worked and he went to fellowship meetings at night, so I never really had a strong connection. But my dad and him and my mum split up when I was 11, and the night that he left, he lifted his hand to me, and it was critic, right. And that happened on a Sunday night, and on a Monday morning I was sent out to school.
Like nothing had happened.
Aye.
And when I think back to a lot of things, it was just go on with it.
And did anybody speak to you about what happened, what your dad did to you?
No, and nobody even spoke to us about my dad leaving the house. You thought, how does this affect you? How is that?
So things weren't talked about in your house. That was quite a norm. Things happen. Don't talk about anything outside the house.
Aye.
Keep it to yourself. Yep. And then...
I don't tell anybody, don't tell school teachers. Yeah.
You've got
these support networks in school, but you can't go and talk to them.
Probably at that time the support networks weren't there in school. This was 1989, so they're probably in, and it was quite new, because I think in this day and age it's no alien for families to be split up and stuff.
It's
like that.
It's more the norm than the...
But in 1989 it was. I didn't know anybody else whose parents had split up. I was the only person that I knew.
There's a shame already, isn't it? Being the child with... this broken, parents aren't together. That's the start of that kind of feeling, isn't it?
So you've got the added shame, and your dad's an alcoholic, and your dad's not there anymore. And I probably didn't realise the things when I was younger. It was only when I got older and I started to do a bit of self-reflecting work on myself that when I thought back, and certainly when I'd done the getting to the root of my core beliefs about myself, that this stuff came before.
You go to school and you're in that bubble and you think, I'm the only mum. It's not got a real mum and dad, or mum and dad's club. Although, because we don't talk... The person sitting next to you could be exactly the same.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can see that. I can sympathise with that.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And I think then what happens is you develop these strategies, don't you? So the bravado strategy was maybe a coping mechanism for not talking. I have to present myself in a different way. I'm not weak.
I have. That was certainly it. Like when I go into the kind of fitback casual scene, I felt as if it was somewhere where I fitted, where I belonged.
Right.
And I'd never really felt that.
That was your tribe?
Aye. I'd never really felt that in life, even when I was younger. Yeah. I remember being younger and kind of looking at other people going, wish I was part of their family, wish I was part of that family. So always that discontent was always within me. When I got into that scene, I still to this day have really good pals that I met at that time. And it was actually... One of the guys that kind of co-founded the group, Keep the Heat with Me, a number of years ago, almost called me out and had went, I kind of know. And I was like, oh, what do you mean? And he's like, I'm kind of the same. He must have seen it in me. And that was almost like a massive relief.
There's someone else like me.
So we kind of spoke that. We kind of spoke things like that as well. And
it's amazing how the power of talking and the connection between two people can actually... shift so much in somebody so quickly, and I'm not alone.
Yep.
There's other people out there like me, and
that's
a powerful story, isn't it?
Just to come back up, the relationship that I got in, it did turn out to be quite abusive, more so emotionally. There was some physical abuse in it, but more so emotionally, and that was the kind of worst thing about it as well. And it's another source of shame as well, as being a man and having to say, I was on the receiver of the abuse. What kind of came through? So there was a period during that where I attempted to take my own life again. I went into the garage and attempted to hang myself in the garage. And Again, it was 2 o'clock in the morning. There was a kind of continuing barrage of abuse that I was getting. Cold shoulder, no speaking to me, and then it would flare up again, and I was just like, wow. And then when I was in the garage, there was a kind of 30-second period where it was just serenity there, and I made that attempt, but I was lucky enough to get my feet back under me and went back out of the house, and it was just quite strange.
I always think that's a piece of hope that something could change that sits within us all, but we can't always access. And it's maybe when you're
like a locked door.
Yeah, when you get to the brink of something, you know, something could maybe, like when you got to the train station, you turned around.
That, when I was in the garage, my mental health actually got worse. It actually really declined. Deteriorated massively for about 6 months after that. I had a lot of input for doctors and GPs, and but at that point my drug taking was becoming really problematic.
Well, that was your coping strategy?
It was very much a coping strategy, and at that point I was open to mental health services, and I've seen a psychologist, and I never clicked, where I was paying at lip service. So I wasn't really doing any of the work because I just felt as if that connection was there, but I felt as if it was something that I had to do. I had nothing else to go on. Kind of during that, I knew that my drug taking was becoming an issue, and I had reached out to a guy via social media who had seen posting, and he was very inspiring, and he seemed to be in a position that I was in, and he was living a healthier lifestyle. And I reached out to him, and we spoke for a bit, and he told me about the fellowship of CA. And I was really against it. I really didn't want to go. But he asked me to go, and it was a meeting via Zoom. And he asked me to go in and just sit and listen.
Did you think you'd a habit, or did you think you were in control?
I knew I was in control.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I knew I was in control, but I was kidding myself on that I was enjoying it. But I wasn't enjoying it. There was times I was internal arguments with myself, not to buy it, but buying it. And taking it and actually crying because I didn't know what to do, but I didn't know
I didn't know how to stop it.
So this guy was really inspiring, and he asked me to go in, and he was sharing on this meeting in Zoom, and I listened to it, and I really identified with it so much. I actually thought the guy was setting me up. I was so deluded. I thought he'd set all this up to
this stems back to you thinking you're the only one in that situation with that only problem.
Your story was so similar to his.
Aye, and I just thought, this seems too coincidental. But I'd slept on it that night, and kind of got a bit of clarity the next morning, and phoned the guy, and he came on the Sunday night, and he took me to a CA meeting, and I started my journey there in fellowship, and went through the 12-step program, which I think it's a beautiful experience, to be honest. I think you can adapt that 12-step program any situation in life. It was really, really good for reflecting on myself and looking to see where I was responsible for things.
Can you tell me what the 12-step program actually is?
So
I'll just touch on it lightly.
It's just adapted from the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. So CA run the same, and I don't want to speak too much because I'm not a representative of CA, and I don't actually do fellowship anymore. I got to a point where I felt a bit disconnected for that as well, and I wasn't really fitting in. And at that point, we had started Keep the Heed, and I really felt it was mainly my mental health that I had to deal with rather than any addiction. I'm not saying that I'm not an addict or anything like that. I felt quite disconnected for that. But I would always encourage somebody to go to a fellowship, because at that point in my life, it saved me. It really helped me. It got me some clarity back in my life, to look to see where I was responsible and stuff. I just later then felt that I was a wee bit disconnected, and I wasn't really fitting in as much, and that was probably more so to do with me and know anything about the fellowship.
And it's maybe also something that you've carried over from childhood, where you were different all those years ago, and in a day that still hangs around.
Possibly.
Because these AA and CA and these meetings are wonderful.
They're absolutely
wonderful. And identification and understanding of it. And a 12-step program is, you know, identifying that you're powerless over whatever it is that you're addicted to. And then you work through your resentments, and you work through your defects of character, and where you want to make amends. And then the end step is to help others, which sounds to me like that's what you're doing now. You've maybe not
This has brought you to...
Yeah, keep the heat, yep. Is like that you're actually actively doing the 12 step.
Aye, so that I suppose is that 12 step, like we're going to get a wee bit back to mm-hmm. people and try to be as much use and as help as possible.
Which ultimately helps you.
It does,
yep.
Keep the heat, just a bit of background and keep the heat and how we came about. My friend,
I love the name, Keep the Heat. It's just so good, isn't it?
It's just so west of Scotland.
That's the reason. I can't take any credit for Connor. It was Ian who was one of the guys that kind of co-founded the group. My pal that I spoke about earlier who'd recognised that anxiety in me. Me and him had met up with Ian, who was the other co-founder, who'd written a book. He'd written a book called The Boy with a Thorn on His Side. And Alan, my pal, had reached out and said, Ian's on this podcast. So I didn't really know Ian. I knew who he was, just through circles and football and stuff like that. He says he's done this podcast and he's written this book. So I watched the podcast and I related to the stuff that he was saying. So I bought his book and I really identified with the book as well. And I think Ian describes his book as semi-autobiographical. There's some parts that are really relatable to his life, but it's a character that's in it and really related to the character. So
is that about addiction then, or is it?
Aye, yeah, uh-huh. But more so drink.
More so drink.
So the three of us had met in Glasgow, and because Mother Pearl does a blog, and he was interviewing him for the blog, and the three of us just sat, and it was good just to sit and speak openly about.
No shame.
Yep. About life events and how we felt and how we coped with things and things that had happened in our life. And the three of us came away from that feeling pretty good. So on the back of that, there was another guy who then thought, we can't be the only guys that feel like this. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should get in a group on the go. So we did. We didn't really know where we were going. We knew that we couldn't meet on a Sunday afternoon in a pub, because we didn't know why I send the wrong message that it was just a booze up for people to come along, because that's what we were trying to move away from. We thought about coffee shops and that as well, but then we're thinking, what if there's tennies, what coffee shops want is then as an added expense for people, maybe if that put people off. So then we were really lucky that the chairman of the Blantyre Soccer Academy wanted to be on board with that and said that we could use the hub there, and that basically became our headquarters. So we met as a group, 6 years met a year ago in February.
Still, was that just word of mouth?
No, so the kind of 6 years knew each other, okay. Or had some sort of connection with each other, and that's when we came and we sat down, and it was Ian that came up with the name Keep the Heat, mm-hmm. And we just thought, yep, that sounds good. Let's go with that. We still didn't know how it was going to run, what we were going to do, where it was going to go. We never did any social media pages, we never had a logo, we never did anything like that. It was just, let's put it on our own social media
safe
pages
space.
And see. Aye. And really that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to create a safe place for guys to come along and talk openly about how they were feeling. We wanted to empower that without any shame, mm-hmm. Break that stigma, just come along. How are you feeling? What are you doing? We didn't want it to be like doom and gloom either. So we wanted to build connections. That's really what the kind of aim of the group was to people have connection with each other, mm-hmm. And have a safe place, mm-hmm. to go along. So the second meeting happened in March, and it was monthly originally, but we had some guys coming through from Edinburgh and Fife, and we made the decision to go fortnightly, which we did. And the groups just grew. When we had loads of people reaching out to us and saying, we can do this for you. So we had people coming along and talking about meditation, and which I do in my life anyway. I meditate. Some guys just didn't know what it was, or were like, I'm not doing
that.
So we had people come along and talk about that. We had people doing some breath work in that ways as well. Somebody came along about journaling and stuff, and they were trying so guys could implement healthy habits in their life. They didn't need to take away everything, because some things didn't work for people and some things do. But so we had loads of people reach out to us for that. We then got the logo up and running. We then get our kind of social media pages running, and we have a WhatsApp group, and the good thing about it is, although we have the group, which is now moved weekly, we decided in December, because we thought December and January may be particularly
difficult.
Bad months.
Difficult months, yeah.
For a number of reasons. Yeah. People with addiction or kind of drink issues, kind of December's the kind of Christmas party season, you know, and that temptation's there. But then there's also a lot of pressure as well, and this kind of things that guys need to go out and earn loads of money to make sure Christmas is going to be all right, and that kind of pressure. So we wanted to run it once a week. It went so well, we've now decided just to keep it once a week as well. And we do have a WhatsApp group, and although we have our standard kind of meeting every Sunday, we have a WhatsApp group where guys will now meet up during the week. So like during the week, some of us will go running. We have at the hub at Blackner Soccer Academy, we have a smaller hub at the back that we can use midweek, and we have a cold water tub there as well. So the guys will go and do running, do some cold water as well.
Brilliant.
We'll meet up on a Saturday morning, maybe Strathclyde Park, we'll go running, and then we'll go for something to eat. Some of the guys have kind of done places like Ben Ann, and I'll go and do this cold water. So what's kind of happened through that is friendships have been made and connections have been made, and people that were isolated are now getting out and about and meeting people and having meaningful relationships with other people.
And do you feel that people you still actively address, like, why somebody's coming along to the group, or is that...
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that, absolutely. There's an element of sharing that goes on then?
So the group on a Sunday, the kind of format would be that, you know, the kind of first 15, 20 minutes is small talk, if you like, mm-hmm. guys just catching up with each other. We're into a kind of 10 to 20 minute meditation in the group. And if you don't want to be part of that, you can just step out of the room at that point. And then we'll have somebody that will share a wee bit in their story, and then people will maybe feedback, and then we'll just kind of bounce things off each other as well and how we do that. And I say there is some really important issues that we do speak about, and none of us are professionals. That's just pure peer-to-peer support. Mm-hmm. And we just share our own experience. So we have some guys where it's issues with addiction and drink. We have some people where it's just low mood, it's anxiety, people it's going through grief. All in all, there's an underlying trauma with everyone. When some guys come in and maybe use the word trauma and say, I've never experienced trauma in my life, and I think
don't know what trauma is.
It's very misunderstood. I would have said, when I was in my mid-30s, I would have said, I've never experienced any trauma, because I would think that's something really bad. But when it was pointed out to me, things like my mum and dad splitting up, my dad being an alcoholic, wee things that were all trauma and they build up. So we try and say that to guys, then go, oh, a wee light bulb comes on, and they think, all right, hang on, I have connected.
That's affected me.
We talk about big T and small T. Yeah. Big trauma, which is massive car crash, and then small T would be maybe failing an exam. So people don't recognize
different levels
that trauma impacts all of us. There's very few of us that haven't experienced some form of trauma, but it's how we learn to cope with it and deal with it.
That's it, and recognizing it as well, and really knowing what it is.
I know.
If you're there to identify and recognize it, it could take a weight off somebody's shoulders. Like you says, that mental health, or when you've had issues in the house at such a young age, somebody can identify that and they'll say to us, how did you deal with it?
Yeah. And that's been
the beauty. How have you
dealt with it? That's been the beauty of the group, because we are sharing an experience. Some guys be like, all right, so I can relate to that, and, you know, how did you deal with that? What did you do? What steps did you take? And it's just been that kind of support network for each other in the group.
I was wondering about why you think men still find it so difficult to talk about their mental health?
I think it's probably just the stigma, and guys need to be guys in that kind of manner. I think the stigma, I think things are a lot better these days, but I think there's still a long way to go for it as well. And I know certainly the pals that I've made at Keep the Head, I can sit and say that, but when I talk to them about anything and say, this is how I'm feeling, I'm pretty comfortable openly talking about my feelings these days. But when I think back to maybe 10 years ago, if I was sitting in the pub with my pals and I told them that I was feeling a bit sensitive the day, I kind of know what the answer's going to be, because I think we've grew up in a culture, especially for guys, where we're expected to put on a brave face. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when you're sitting about with your pals, it's a lot of slagging and all that goes on. It's a lot of kidology as well. It still kind of puts you off at opening up, because you think, well, I'm going to get
both barrels and down the throat.
If I say something that makes me look weak or vulnerable or whatever, that'll be the brunt of a joke next week kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a generation thing? Do you think that the generation below us are more open to expressing themselves and identifying the way they're feeling?
I'm not actually sure, and the reason I'm not actually sure of that is because I think we're seeing an epidemic of young people with mental health, and I think that's came because if you only look back 4 years ago, we're told to isolate ourselves, but we're told not to go out and not to mingle with people, COVID. So people isolated themselves, and there's been real disconnection with people, and I think in the back of that, we've seen an epidemic of poor mental health in young people, and the cocaine consumption in this country is... It's an epidemic. And I think the way cocaine is made, or the effects of cocaine, is really quite bad. You know, it doesn't seem to be certainly not a drug that's only for the rich these days, and it certainly doesn't seem to be a drug that's sociable these days, because people, when you hear people coming into like fellowship or groups like ourselves, they're telling you they're sitting on their own. And they're taking it, so they're not talking to anybody, they're sitting on their own, they're isolating themselves, and their coping mechanism is to take drugs for that. So it's very sort of,
on both levels, on a physical and...
Yep. So I'm not actually sure if people are mere thinking to open up these days. I think there's still a long way to go.
I agree with you. I think that there's still a stigma around. I'm actually not sure now how much of a gap there is between men and women, to be honest. I think... It's easy to say that men are, particularly in this part of the world, there's that reluctance to speak. I think women are also, there's an element of women who are the same.
I think it's culture these days, because we live in a very much a culture where social media is massive, and people will look in social media. You can be anybody you want to be in social media, and there's almost that, becomes competitive and trying to keep up with other people. And I think social media does have its place, and it is really good, because when I look at like groups like Keep the Heat and all that, we've made connections through social media.
Well, that's the way I got in touch with yourself.
Of course.
I looked at a local group, where can we get somebody involved to spread the word?
Yeah.
And you're just across the road from me.
Yeah.
Going back to the social media, I remember I was in my friend's house with his girl, came crying, and I said, what's wrong? I put my new dress on and put it on social media, and I only get 8 likes, and my pal get 12 likes. And you think to yourself,
I don't know.
That's the thing that I think about, that is it's trying to connect, isn't it? It's trying to get some affirmation. It's trying to get somebody to affirm them where they can't affirm themselves. If you've got low self-esteem and you're on social media and you put a picture up that's altered by all sorts of different apps to make yourself look amazing, and then you get 40 likes, that person thinks that's great, I'm doing really well.
It becomes that, addictive as well,
social
media.
That'll last for about 2 seconds.
That kind of chasing that.
High.
One minute you're a diamond, the next time you're a piece of coal. Yeah. It's the same thing, exactly the same element, just that you're a diamond one day.
I think there's probably over the last few years, there's definitely been an increase in championing men's mental health, but it's almost like the balance is tipping now, because there's loads and loads of groups popping up for men's only mental health groups, and really not so much for women. It's almost like women know how to speak, they know how to talk about their feelings.
But do you know where that originated from? Especially in Glasgow, the Glasgow Steamy. The back room.
Of course.
The tenement buildings, that's where all the women would sort the problems of the world out. And then
used to go to the baths as well, and go and wash in the baths.
But men had to go down the pub or watch football. They didn't talk about feelings, whereas when women were doing the washing of the clothes, as sexist as that feels, like that was why a lot of women probably spoke more than men.
I know there is a few women's groups about, but there seems to be more focus on men's mental health.
Well, there's not many women's groups about.
No, there isn't.
Really? In terms of,
I think there's one up in North Glasgow, up in St Rocks. I think there's one up there. I don't know if it's a Sunday morning.
There are. You know, there's not a huge amount out there for women to talk. Uh-huh. And certainly when I look at my friendship groups and things like that, I've got good friends that I can talk to. But not everybody will feel that way. And for me, the thing that struck me about your group was that core to it was the connection. That was so important, that you had connection and you could find connection with others.
Yeah.
And in connection, there's also identification. And when you find identification, there can be a certain... Oh, great, I'm not a stranger, I'm not a weirdo, I'm not...
I think even with the group once a week, the feedback that we had was, we're really glad this went to once a week, because people are looking forward to coming once a week as well. And that's why we have kind of stuff on during the week, kind of midweek as well, so people still get somewhere to go and can still have that connection.
Do you think that's because if you've identified yourself in that situation, you've pulled yourself away from possibly that group of friends? You've taken, like you say, the football casual. You've lost or disconnected from that group of friends?
There is some truth in that, and I've still got pals that are still pals to this day that I made through that scene, but there is...
I'm not saying it's just because something else, it could be flying the pigeons or the music scene or...
I think when you do become authentic to yourself and become true to your own self, you are going to disconnect with people that you connected with when you weren't being authentic, if that makes sense.
No,
because then if you're being true to yourself and you've not really got much in common with the people that you were making connections with, because you were, you know, under a false character, really.
I also think that when you start to do that work that you've done on yourself, you start to identify who's adding to me. You know, who are the people in my life that are adding to me and celebrate me, as opposed to tolerating me or taking from me? And it can be quite a difficult cull, if you like.
It is, and I've had to experience that myself. Mm-hmm. I used to think that the more pals I had, the better a person I would be.
I think that's a man thing as well,
that's
sometimes.
A measure.
I think that's a measure of man. That's a good, uh-huh. good. I don't Facebook nothing, but I've got all these pals. And kind of similar to yourself, I did a call about 5 years ago, and rather than going for quantity, I went for quality. Yeah. And I can hold up one hand now. Guys, I can pick up 3 o'clock in the morning and go,
yep,
I need help. Mm-hmm. I need to talk.
Absolutely, yeah. I noticed when I stopped drinking and taking drugs and that, the invites to places dried up pretty quickly. And I was fine with that, because I was the site I was wanting to be in, you know. But there is a, kind of going through that though, you almost grieve, because it was a life that I had for so long, and people that were in that life for so long. So there's like a, almost like a process of grief.
Do you ever think that I could wish I could go back for that wild weekend, yep, or that night in the terrace, just to say I was there? And
absolutely. There is times where I think that
you had a crack night that night.
And it was like, although I'm sitting here and I don't do the things that I was doing 10, 15 years ago, there was times where I had some really good times, and I'll always remember them and cherish them. But what it done was it led to me into a really dark place where I don't want to go back.
A downward spiral.
Absolutely.
So keep the heat. Meet every week. You've got the gym. You've got your groups on midweek. What's the future for it? Can we buy a franchise? Can we get shares in a franchise?
So we see. But we've signed a partnership agreement with Shorts Prison.
Oh, fantastic!
So it was an independent prison monitor that reached out to us via social media a number of months ago, who she'd went in and done some work in there and had identified a gap. Where people really couldn't talk about their mental health or how they were feeling within mm-hmm. there. Their governor and their deputy governor are really pretty forward thinking. And they invited myself and Ian for the group up for a meeting, and we went up and we met with them, and we just told them what the group was. And it's almost like we have that imposter syndrome where we think, this is a bit too much for us. We're just running the mill guys that started this group. But we told them kind of what the group was. We probably tried to, not try to talk ourselves at it, but downplay it a wee bit in case they thought, oh, we're working up with some sort of magic solution that was going to, we just told them what it was about. They said it sounded really good. So we went back to the group and we asked who wanted to be involved in it, because we knew just going to be 2 or 3 years going up and facilitating this group week in, week out. So but we have made 8 guys that wanted to be involved in it, which was really good. I think that speaks volumes for the people that we have in the group, that they're willing to give us back. We can have, so people don't turn up every week, and we make that clear to people that, you know, got your hostage here.
If you need this kind of thing, you want to come
once every 2 or 3 months, that's fine. We do have a wee core mm-hmm. that's built a friendship, and we'll be there every week. But we have a WhatsApp group with around 60 people uh-huh. on it.
That's amazing.
That's wonderful.
So we have about 60. And some people will just use the WhatsApp group as well, and that's fine. We're not precious with that, because
sometimes it's better if it's a faceless.
Because we do get that sometimes it can be overwhelming for people to come into a group. And the group has got busier in the last few weeks, and sometimes that can be overwhelming for people.
How would somebody come to the group? Because there's a big, you've got to have a lot of courage to walk into a group setting, haven't you?
Especially being a man, if you're struggling with anything.
So sometimes it's word of mouth. Some people might have a pal that goes to the group and thinks, so well, wait there, you've done that, mm-hmm. I feel that as well, I'll come along with you. But we have people that will just reach out to our social media, or people that will reach out and say, my son, my husband, my pal, I think would benefit for this group. And what we say is, look, if they're a bit apprehensive about walking up to the door and coming in, if they want to use your phone number, we'll add you to the WhatsApp group. You can have a feel for who's in the group and kind of what the chat is like. Or somebody will come and meet you at the Baltimore Lane. Somebody will meet you maybe the day before and have a coffee with you and say, this is what our group's about. Or if you want to turn up at 1:45, somebody will walk down the bottom of the road and meet you and walk through the door with you as well. But there are some guys that just come up and say, I've heard about the group and I want to come in, and fair play to them. And I don't know if I would have been able to.
I know, it takes so much courage to make yourself that vulnerable and to step through those doors.
It does. So, yeah, we've got the partnership with shots. Eight of us are going to go up and facilitate that group. We'll just rotate it as well. So we went up, eight of us went up, they invited us up, and we had a tour of the prison, which was quite daunting, actually. Quite humbling, to be honest.
I'm in the scaffolding industry. Started life as a labourer, blah, blah, blah. And I remember doing one of the halls in Berlin, got a scaffold right down it, and you look at a prison cell, and it put me off. I mean, I came from a typical suburban Glasgow housing estate where you go one or two ways. And I've worked with old one, I'm saying, is this a room? He's like, no, that's a room for two.
Yep. That's the, so in shorts, they let us see inside one of the cells. And what was really struck me was, they said that 9 o'clock at night, the door will get closed, and it could be somebody that's in a cell on their own, and they don't see or speak to anybody until 8 o'clock the next morning. And it's, you've not got a phone, and anybody can pick up the phone or text or distract yourself. You're just sitting there with your own thoughts. Mm. And when I sat and thought about that, I was like, wow, that's quite a sobering thought, actually. Yes. If you've got a lot of stuff going on in your head and there's nobody.
I've got Fritzi Horsman coming. I don't know if Fritzi, who does the Compassionate Prison Project.
Yes.
I don't
know her, but I know some people that's kind of linked in, where I know, I think the organisation, it's Natalie Logan's organisation that's linked in with them as well, and has done so. Cisco.
So there's Tigers and Aces and things like that, Ace of Your Nation, things like that. So she's going to come on our podcast.
Oh, superb. Brilliant.
Which is fantastic. But her,
I think the reason Shorts had reached it to us as well, because it's a long term prison, it's a long term sentence prison. So there's only about 50 or 60 people liberated for there a year. Usually, when you're coming up to the end of your sentence, you would move to another prison or up to like an open prison as well. So we went up and done the tour, we met 12 of the inmates, and what they were saying is a lot of them go to fellowship meetings that are within there, but none of them have actually got any drink or drug issues. It's just somewhere for them to go where they can see how they're feeling.
So they're looking for that connection again.
And it was very well received like that. So we were actually going up tomorrow night to do a bit of training before we go in and take the group in there.
That's fantastic. Yeah. That's so good. I do think the more that we can help people, because for me, the whole thing about prisoners and their trauma warehouses, as far as I'm concerned, but if we can actually help them, then ultimately that also then helps their families and potentially stops some of the cycle of behaviour that can go on.
It helps the community as well, because they're coming out the north end, and it's...
Our hope would be that when we go up there and we facilitate the group, that when they go back down into cells or into their halls, that kind of spreads, and then that peer-to-peer support works, and that kind of breaks down throughout the halls, and it just spreads a wee bit, because certainly that's what we've found within our communities. We had our open day yesterday, and it was beautiful to see families and all that coming along, because and the ripple effect and people feeding back to say, oh, I can't believe the difference. You know, and we had some guys that were there with their partners and saying that they're basically shoved out the door on a Sunday and told to come to a meeting, because when they come back, they're happy. And
they're taking that weight off their shoulders.
It's good feedback to hear as well.
Do you find that, obviously you're part of this group now, Keep the Heed, and you were talking about earlier about you're quite open about talking about your feelings and things like that. Yeah. Would you be like that with everyone?
Oh, put me in the spot. I think I'm pretty open. And I would like to think that I would be, because if it's leading by example, and if I'm opening up and saying how I'm feeling, then somebody else might go, well,
barriers have come down.
And I think it's that kind of trust thing as well. If I'm being open how I'm feeling, then
I'll show you my hand. Can you show me yours now?
Aye. So I do think I'm pretty open about talking about my feelings. I might not delve into everything that's happened in my life with just anybody. If I'm not feeling great, I'm pretty open about just telling somebody that, you know.
But I guess the reason I was asking that question is some people will be able to talk openly in an environment where they feel safe and they can trust. But if they're in a scenario where perhaps, say, even in a family situation where the family's maybe been the cause of some of the challenge, that they might not have that space sometimes when they go back home or go out into their work environment, for example. And you're obviously in the construction industry. And I was trying to think of guys that go to Keep the Heed, but then they go to the building site, and are they talking about what they did at the weekend? It was with the group Keep the Heed, or am I still playing the part? So I'm not talking. So I'm wondering about the ripple effect.
But my experience of people being in the group is that they are quite
open to it.
You know, they promote the group in groups like us. So
that's the difference then, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because A and C are anonymous, and a lot of people don't necessarily say that they're in these groups, whereas Keep the Heat.
Yep.
You're wearing the badge.
Aye, and I think we try and move away from calling it a mental health group, and we try and kind of call it a positive wellbeing group, because that does sound a bit better. Yeah. When you say mental health people, I think people just think we're all sitting about doom and gloom and hankies and crying.
But mental health is used wrongly.
Yes.
Because we all have mental health. It's whether we've got good mental health or bad mental health.
But I think when you say mental health, people all go with this kind of negative.
Exactly.
It's like you said, the first thing you did is went to the doctors. What did he do? It was a packet of pills.
Yeah. I think on Saturday, for example, we were 6 years, we'd went to run Strathclyde Park on Saturday, and then we went to a wee cafe and something to eat, and the 6 years were there, and the conversation was pretty deep. One of the guys was talking about just a recent breakup and how it was making him feel, and we were really sharing stories and stuff like that, but there was a lot of laughter in that there. And I think if anybody walked out of that cafe, you wouldn't have sat and thought, that's six guys that have really struggled with their feelings, because we were quite openly talking and we were able to, there was laughter in that there. There was some real meaningful conversations going on, but if anybody had walked in, you wouldn't have thought that, you know, there was anything negative in it.
And I think that's a great picture to paint for people who are maybe wondering about what's it going to be like? Is it going to be all doom and gloom? No, we can actually talk and laugh and deep chat at the same time.
We have the conversations, but I see real friendships and connections have been made. So there's a lot of trust within people in the group. And there is a core ace who have made really meaningful friendships, where I know I can pick up the phone to them and say, here's how I'm feeling.
Fancy a walk and fancy a chat.
And that's just what happened. Mm-hmm. We will do that, and we'll arrange to meet during the week. And we try and encourage positive kind of habits with each other. So like, we'll maybe remind each other, if you journaled the day, are you journaling done the day, you know?
Yeah, well, have you done to help yourself?
I often say that, obviously, being a counsellor, we work with our clients and we give them homework.
Yeah.
And the reality is, 90% of the change happens outside of the room. So it's the 10% that you're with them is great, but you really need to be committed, like you were saying earlier, to doing stuff.
And that's where I fell down in the past. Mm-hmm. I've done kind of counselling and therapy and that before, but I thought just being in that room and talking for that hour and doing stuff within that room was going to fix me. Mm-hmm. So when I was back out in the outside world, which was causing me all my stress and anxiety, I wasn't actually implementing any things. It wasn't until I started last year doing that. What can also help me was doing the 12-step programme. I was implementing the 12-step programme and the principles every day in my life, where I was able to reflect on my day and take responsibility and stuff and have a lot of acceptance. Right. And then when I decided, well, I need to go and look at what my core beliefs are, because there was still something underlying that I still didn't feel quite good enough. So I had to go and do the core beliefs. What I'd done this time was the homework that I was being given, I was doing it and I was implementing it, which was where I was able to go back, and it's helped me massively. Whereas before, I just thought, I'm going to come into a room and speak to you and you're going to fix me. So when I walk out of this room, if anything's gone wrong, then that's your fault, because you've not fixed me. That was my outlook on it.
And I think that's the thing about therapy and counselling. It's your counsellor's walking alongside you. They shouldn't be there. They're not there to fix you. They're there to help you in that journey and the
counsellor that I do have, I've got a really good rapport with her. First week we made an agreement that if that connection wasn't there, we would review it and then we would just call it quits.
Yeah. But I think that's the same with all practices and all counsellors. I think there's, if you don't have that,
I would actively say, if you came in to me and there wasn't what we call the therapeutic relationship, the therapeutic alliance, and didn't feel comfortable with me, then I would not want the client to continue with me, and vice versa, if I didn't feel comfortable with the client, because it's then not going to benefit them at all. And certainly I wouldn't be able to work with them. And
as I said earlier, when I was working with a psychologist, I think 2019, and I had no connection where at all, absolutely zero. And I was paying it lip service and not being truthful and being quite dishonest. I've done that, yep, no, I don't take drugs and stuff like that. And I've really been dishonest. because I don't know if that was because I felt judged or I never had that connection. I thought, I don't want you coming away from this and going, he's hopeless.
It's really important. Don't continue with something if you're noticing that. And that's powerful information.
Yeah.
We're going to ask everybody that comes onto our podcast for their best piece of advice, and I wanted to know what's been the best piece of advice you've ever been given.
It's just to talk how I'm feeling, regardless of who it is. Just talk openly. I don't mean just grab a stranger in the street, but it's about not to suffer in silence. Where I've been in the past, I have kept silent, and it led me to some really dark places. So if you are feeling disconnected, you're feeling isolated, and you think there's nobody out there that's going to really want to talk to me, there absolutely is. There's hundreds upon thousands of people that want to listen to you, will identify with what's going on with you. And it's when you do that and you open up, there is floodgates that open. It's a massive relief.
If any of people's identified with what they've heard today or what they've seen today and they want to get involved, how do they contact Keep the Heat Group?
We have our social media pages. We're on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok and Twitter.
We've covered them all.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if there's any that we're not. But we also have our email address as well. And I think just before I came here today, I had a missed call. My phone, it was a guy who'd said he'd got my number for you. So we have leaflets in that as well. Okay. But one of them must have been posted on social media and my number was on it. So he'd phoned me. So we had a wee kind of brief chat in that there. And hopefully he's going to start coming along to the group.
Brilliant. So there's plenty of ways for people to get in contact with you.
There is as well. Yep. If you go to any social media and just put in Keep the Heat, one of our social media pages will pop up. And we can just, our messages are always open for people.
That's wonderful. Really good to hear you talking like that. It's so interesting to hear your journey and how you've got to where you've got to,
and the fact that you're encouraging, you're helping other guys, and
that helps me massively. To be honest, I got a kind of sense of purpose in that out of that as well, and it's no ego or anything like that. I know where I've been, and the thought of somebody else going through that or sitting feeling isolated doesn't sit well with me, and I wouldn't want anybody to go through that. But it does help me as well, you know, it makes me feel good, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's your new drug.
Yep, absolutely.
That's the best thing for you, isn't it?
It's healthy.
It's healthy.
Like me, my music, if I ever feel lower, I just go and put my music on. Yeah. It takes me to a good place.
Yeah. But the thing is, people don't recognise what's unhealthy and what's healthy.
I've done it myself for a lot of years. I thought being out and about and acting Jack the Lad was healthy and that was going to keep me happy, but, you know, I had a short window where that feeling lasted, and then it just became something almost like a character I had to try and maintain, but inside I was crumbling, really.
I think where people are dependent on, so people are easily recognised drugs and alcohol or gambling, but there's so many what we call process addictions or dependencies, like social media. You can't get off your phone, you're on your phone all the time. You're buying stuff online, you're shopping constantly, and you're spending all the money. And
you talk about me personally?
No, not
you. I was just going to say, I think I've went through that every cycle.
People don't recognise that these are behaviours that give you that hit to the endorphin, and then 2 minutes later, as soon as they've pressed the buy something button, what now? And so people are not necessarily aware of all the other things that are like what we call process.
I think it's that constantly seeking validation as well. Yeah. Can be quite addictive if you're always looking, not really being at peace with yourself or being accepting of who you are. Still go online and look at jackets that cost a couple of £100, but I always stop myself and think, who am I buying this for? Is it to impress somebody else, or is it really because I like it? And 9 out of 10 times, my answer is always it's to impress somebody else, for somebody else to say to me, I like your jacket, where did you get?
I'm just leaving the shopping basket and check in again.
No.
The thing people don't understand is that the neural pathways that you create in your brain, the ones that you had from childhood that you've created, they don't go away. Yeah. They're always there. It's the new neural pathways that you want to keep walking down, if you like. So, you know, you've got a pathway for finding things that are helpful for you, might give you that hit, but you're now going, hang on a minute, I'm not doing that anymore. Yeah. I'm doing this instead. And so that's
had the same effect.
Yeah, and it's better to recognise that, and I'm doing this to impress somebody else. Why is it I need to impress somebody else? And what's going on in me? And that's the
that
thing.
Goes back to my core beliefs, yeah, you know, about not being good enough. So if I buy a jacket, it's £500, will that make me good enough?
Aye.
It's a profound thought that it will, but then overall, no.
No,
because I have done that in the past, where I had spent a fair amount on a jacket, and then 2 days later, I see somebody else with another jacket, and I go, I want that. So it's that always been discontent, and I've really been happy with what I've got, and always chasing something else. And it's not until I really started to work on myself. And I'm not saying that there are still moments where I think, oh,
like a jacket.
I just think these days I've got more awareness.
Absolutely. It's that awareness, isn't it? That's really important. Aye. Yeah. Yep. I think youngsters are very into the trainers. That seems to be the big thing about the latest trainers, isn't it?
I think it maybe goes back to social media as well.
But then kids are bullied at school because they're not wearing the right trainers or whatever. Yeah.
Trainers have always been there. It's not just now.
I know.
Adidas.
Adidas, I think. If you can go back to the early 80s, no, I think
Ruckner, some people would remember Ruckner.
I think if you go back to the early 80s, then people would started their Adidas collection then.
I know.
Nike Air Jordans.
I know. One thing that I think is also really important for people is, so say somebody came in to me and said, oh, I do exercise a lot and I'm at the gym every day and I'm working out really hard. Do you know what that is? That's addiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because people think, oh, this is healthy for me, this is good for me, but actually, why are you at the gym so much, doing so much, over-the-top behaviour?
We have a guy that comes to keep the heat down, and he's a great ambassador for the group, and we've started to nickname him the Kenyan, because he came to me, he's around 80 days clean and sober, if he's drinking kind of illicit substances. He came to me and never really said anything for a few weeks. He looked pretty broken, and then he started joining in, going the running, and he's running half marathons every day. And his doctors had to tell him to slow down because he's got right into it, and he loves it, and he's immersed himself in the group, and he would post up every time he goes a run. He'll take a wee selfie outside the hub with a Keep the Heat sign, and he'll put it on his social media.
But people just swapping one addiction for another.
But it's healthy until his doctor said that his ankle wasn't going to really be able to cope with the half marathons every day, so he had to slow down, you know. So
I'd be starts buying trails though.
I know.
Listen, thank you so much, David. Oh,
thanks very much for
really
having me on.
Really appreciate your time, and we definitely want to follow your journey and see how well Keep the Heat does in the future, because it sounds like it's going from strength to strength, and maybe get you back and you can tell us a bit more about how you got on in the prisons and what's happening there.
That would be great. Thanks. I'm really grateful you've asked me on, honestly.
Well, thanks for
humbling.
Being so open and honest with us. It's refreshing to hear another guy talk and about his journey and about his demons and how he's addressed them. And hopefully somebody will be listening going, that's me. And
I think if even one person does, then it's just worthwhile.
You make a change.
Yeah. That's why we're doing it. Even if one person hears it then and it makes a difference to their life, then that's been worth it.
When we started the group as well, we're not really caring if there was two people turned up or 200 people. As long as somebody was getting something out of it and it was helping somebody, then
that's brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you.